Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Bill.
My name's Billy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Billy.
A while back, Elena, she knew she was going to be speaking down here in December, right? And this goes back a few months, and I thought, well, cool, she's speaking. You know, that's all good. I'll just, you know, come down and support her and drive her down and drive her back. And I'll just sit in the back where I always sit, back on death row, and I'll enjoy her speaker meeting. And probably a month ago, she says, you know what, they told me I got to get a warm-up speaker. And will you warm up the speaker for me? And I said, yeah, I will. Then I started getting nervous, and the fear set in, you know. So anyway, I tell you, we came down tonight. We listened to a speaker on the way down, and we went and ate dinner with Rick and his wife. And, man, it was a beautiful thing. And it's, you know, only in AA. Rick and I connected on some levels. And you know, it's a funny thing when you sit across the table from somebody and you're open with them and you start identifying as an alcoholic. You know, what comes out and how you can connect, you know. And it was a special deal. And so I feel right at home right here. Right? I was born and raised in a small town, Fowler, out there, and out in the country, and I come down here, and it feels like home, you know. And but I was like I said, I was born out in the country, and I can remember my mom took me into kindergarten. I had to go into town, you know what? And as I lined up, and everybody lined up, I could see everybody talking to each other. And I thought, man, they all know each other, and I don't know nobody. Because they were interacting with each other, and I didn't know how to do that at an early age. And so I started crying, and my mom took me home the first day. And so and I went back, and the next day, you know what? But I always felt like I was on the outside looking in, everywhere I went, all my life, you know what? And I remember at 14, after a football game one night, a bunch of us pitched in a dollar, and we went to the liquor store and had one of the older guys buy us some beer. So we went out in the country and we started drinking that beer, you know what? And for me, that when I started drinking, in the big book it talks about the effect produced by alcohol. And for me, that effect produced by alcohol is it took away all the fears. All those fears that I was living with, always from the outside looking in, not enough, not measuring up, the bar's always a little bit too high. I take a drink, and it just levels the playing field. And I fit right in. I could talk. I could go up and carry conversations with people. And so I had found my solution at that minute to life, you know. And so I didn't, you know, I didn't become a full-blown alcoholic overnight, but I knew the sense of ease and comfort that I felt from drinking, and so I did that at every chance I could get, you know. And tell you the truth, I don't know how I graduated from high school, and they kind of shuffled us through, and it was my turn to graduate, and I went up and I walked across the stage and picked up a diploma. And I think they got tired of me, just wanted to get me out of there. But I started going to school, you know. My friends were going to Reedley College, and I thought, well, I'll go over there too. Pretty soon my drinking and outside issues started getting more important than the school. And so alcoholic of my type, I quit school. And so I could drink the way I wanted to drink, you know. And I'll fast forward a little bit. I did that for a number of years. And in and out of jail, in and out of prison, my mom was always there sending me packages, putting together all this stuff because of drinking. Some people go to jail for other reasons. Every time I went and got locked up, it was because of my drinking and using every time. And So I had, my mom was always there and my uncle was always there, you know, and they were just down-to-earth people, just normal people, down-to-earth, man. And they were through. They had gotten so tired of my stuff that they had just come to terms with my drinking. And they figured I was going to die that way, and I did too. I didn't care anymore. I had paroled, and I remember back in 94, and my uncle passed away, and he left me a home was fully paid for. And in 2003, in a drunken stupor, I had quit paying insurance at that home, and I accidentally burned it down. And I had always had a place to stay. I had a place to live, you know what? And I always thought it was going to be okay, you know what? And when I burned that home down and ended up on the streets of Fresno, I was losing hope, you know what? But as Rick and I were talking tonight, that's probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because I hit my bottom then, you know what? And I got arrested when I burnt the home down. They found some outside issues in that home, and they sent me to a program is what they did. I went to a program and I left. And I got picked up again and I went back to jail, and they sent me back over to that program and I left. And I've been doing that stuff all my life. I've been walking away from the same places that always wanted to help me, you know, and I did it with my uncle, I did it with my mom, and I did it again at this with the judge in the recovery home that they had sent me to. In 2005, I was sent back over there, and I didn't go over there for recovery. I went over there to get the judge off my back, and I figured if I could stay there 30 days, I might put some little distance between that judge and I. And I get in her good graces, because she was getting tired of seeing me one more time. And what happened when I got there is I surrendered. I surrendered in my heart, man. I did that 18-inch drop from my head to my heart, and then something happened for me. And what that was God relieved me of the obsession to drink and use. And I knew that was a God thing, man, because I couldn't do that on my own. And I knew that had to be Him. I don't come from, like praying and church, and none of that was in my life. But I knew that something bigger in me was working in me. And when that was taken, so I started saying little prayers in the morning, like, you know what, just simple, thank you. Thank you that I don't have to live that way anymore, or think that way. Because every day I woke up, I was going to hurt somebody, or somebody was going to steal something, or I was just in the chaos, and I didn't have to do that anymore. And what happened was H&I came in to that program, and they started carrying this message, and I started identifying with it. And they said, when you get out of here, make a meeting. When you get out. And I did. I took some direction for the first time in my life, and I went to AA. And my home group's Life on Life's Terms, group of Alcoholics Anonymous, were right over on Fulton and Belmont, right across the back alley from the methadone program that I had gone to for 25 years. And So I continue going over to that meeting, you know what, and I found a lot of people, man, a lot of love right there, you know, and I started taking direction, you know, and I started doing this deal, man. I was free. I didn't have to live that way no more. And if you're new or fairly new in there, I want to tell you, you don't have to live that way anymore either. AA's given me a solution, you know what? And I got a sobriety date. It's May 25th of 2005. I've got a sponsor who's Pat B. He's in Las Vegas. They're at the State Line Retreat this weekend over there. I've got my home group. and I work with others, just like my sponsor worked with me. You know, and I take men through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and this solution that we have here, you man, from my heart, man, I love you people. I fell in love with AA when I came into the. I remember my home group. I started going there every day, man. I couldn't get enough of you. I just couldn't, man. I couldn't get enough of your of what was going on here. And I said to myself, I finally found my people. I always was on that outside looking in, you know. And so AA has given me a life, you know what, that I've never had before. And what that is some peace in my heart and in my mind, you know what. And when I go to bed at night, I can sleep, and I don't have the committee. Don't get me wrong, the committee, it goes sometimes. But you know what? I got some tools there today to take care of that. You know what? So, anyway, you know what? Elena wanted me to speak for 15 minutes. It's 10 minutes. And so, I better shut up. But I want to thank all of you for welcoming us here, and it's special. And thank you.
Okay, let's give a rousing welcome to our warm up. I mean, our featured speaker, Elena.
Thank you.
How's that?
Good.
Okay.
My name is Elena, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Elena.
And I'm hella nervous. You know, and but it's a good nervous, you know. And my sponsor always tells me, you know, Elena, just put your hand in your heart, and you know, speak from the heart. And you know, that's what I'm gonna do: share my experience, strength, and hope. And I want to thank Rick for inviting me to speak, and the dinner was awesome. I almost wanted to go home and sleep afterwards. I was all comfortable. But no. My story began a little about my experiences. I grew up in a small town, too. I grew up in a small town called Malaga. I grew up in a small town called Malaga. It was a little town. And I grew up in a very dysfunctional home. I grew up in a typical Hispanic family. It was a very violent family I grew up in. It was a lot of fighting. It was dysfunctional. It was just dysfunctional. And I grew up, and I was that little girl that learned to disassociate at a young age from a lot of things that were happening and to me and around me. And at the age of 12 was where I found that comfort. At the age of 12, I drank my first beer. It was Olympia. I don't know if everybody tastes Olympia, but Olympia was my first beer. My father was an alcoholic. My mom had a mental illness, which I know of today. I didn't know back then that my mom had a mental illness. And so those are the kind of parents I had. And my father would drink, and when my father would get drunk, he would leave his beers half empty. And me and my friend, we would drink them. You know, we'll drink whatever was left. And when I drank them, I didn't like the feeling. It tastes nasty, but the way it made me feel afterwards, that warmth, I found another way to check out, you know, like numb out. And so I started drinking at the age of 12, but probably 11, you know. And from there, I graduated. I was a ghetto drinker. I drank Thunderbird, you know. In that little town I grew up in, there was a lot of heroin addicts, alcoholics, and you know, there was always that Thunderbird. And so I graduated to Thunderbird, and I liked it, that bird, that feeling. And from there I went to Baca, you know. And along the way, you know, I'm growing up, and at a very young age, I left home at the age of 13 years old. You know, I left home, and I was always getting locked up. You know, and it's sad to say, but when I was getting locked up, it's when I always felt safe. I don't know if that makes sense. You know, like, nobody couldn't hurt me. Nobody couldn't get to me. I, you know, it was like being locked up, 5 months at a time or whatnot was like a safe place for me. And my life went like that. I just drank and I smoked a little bit of weed too, but I drank a lot then in my early teens. And then at the age of 15, I got in a relationship. You know, I thought he was going to save me, looking for love in the wrong places, because I was always looking for something, this emptiness. I can't even put a word to it, but I was always looking for something, and I thought he was going to fix me. And he was young, I was young, and it was crazy. It was abusive. He would hit me a lot, and I just drank and did other things, you know, not to feel. And it went on like that, you know, it went on like that till I was 18. At the age of 18, I had my first daughter, and I always talk about this first daughter, you know, and it can still bring tears to my eyes, because when I had this little girl and I held her, you know, I felt like I was going to love her, like I was going to give her the love that I never had or something. I don't know. I was just going to love this little girl, like, you know, this was it, you know, and that's what I believed at that time. And I can still get watery because I love that. She's my firstborn, you know. And this little girl, I was going to love her, and I did. I took care of her for her first year, you know. I didn't drink. I didn't do nothing. I was a good mom, as I thought I was, you know, and I took care of her. And then that relationship with her dad was still going on. It was a lot going on, and I was hurting. I was lost. I didn't know a lot. Then I got pregnant again. I had another daughter in the same year. It was rabbit season. Yeah, just kidding. I always say it was rabbit season. I had 2 kids within the same year, you know. And I like when people laugh because they can relate. It's a program of identification. And so I had this second little girl, and you know, and I said, oh my God, I have 2 little babies, you know. And I was trying to do it, and it was hard. And then I began to drink again. I began to drink and get to do dry goods. That's part of my story. I was asked to share my story, and that was part of my story. And, you know, that went on, and raising these little kids the best I can. And then I had another little girl, my third daughter. And by the time I had this little girl, I was full-blown in my disease. I was full-blown. You know, I was there, but not there, you know, for these little girls. And that relationship kind of went, I don't know, it was weird. And I didn't care. I didn't care. Like something happened to me that I just shut down, and I didn't care. And I went like full force in my disease. And I still had these little girls, you know, and CPS never got involved in my life. At times I wished they would have. They never, you know, and I dragged my kids through the mud, you know, and I don't say it with pride, you know. You know, things happened to those kids that should have never happened to any kids, you know. And I ended up going to prison a few times, getting locked up where my disease took me. I ended up going, you know, for the next several years in my 20s, I was locked up in prison. And these little girls are growing up, and they're being raised by family, and family that's supposed to, what I thought, supposed to take care of them, you know, while I was in prison. And things are happening, and every time I would get out and I would see things that were happening, the shame and guilt would get me back to drinking, because I didn't like what I had done to my kids. I didn't like my life, so I would continue to drink, and the disease just went on and on, and my life went like that. And then I met another man, and we had got introduced to the other program, the other 12-step program, and I still drank, you know. I would be clean, not sober, clean, you know. And then a year, look at me, a year, no dry goods. Let me go celebrate and drink. I go straight to the bar, you know. And I remember celebrating one of my first years in L.A. at a meeting called the Long Haul. It was an industrial part of L.A. And you know, and that went on. And then the disease just kept going and going. And these little girls were growing up. My daughters are growing up, and I'm in that disease, and it's just going on. A lot of things are happening. You know, it just goes on and goes on. And there would be moments where I would be clean and stop, but it would just go back. It wasn't really real. And this went on for a lot of years, you know. And what happened in the end was My sobriety date is September the 19th, 2005. That's my sobriety date. And what happened at that time was I had been out in the streets and, you know, doing what I had to do to survive in the streets. You know, I was out there in the streets for almost a year. My parole officer kept giving me dry outs. I think he gave me about 11 of them, 9 or 11 of them. He was a really nice parole officer. You know, he liked me. He was cool. And but finally one day he said, you know, Elena, we can't do this. You know, I can't keep giving you dry outs, you know. So he told me that I was going to have to go to a program. And I said, okay, you know. He goes, oh, that is a violation. And so I'm supposed to report to a program on a Friday, and I do report. I turn in my clothes and everything, but not me. I walk out the door, and I didn't turn myself into that Monday. And you know, a friend of mine who was also in a disease, it was kind of funny, you know. But she took me. She took me to the program, and I guess somewhere I was tired, you know. But I just didn't know how to surrender. You know, I was tired, but I kept going and going. And I remember going to that program, and the first 3 days, I think I slept. I woke up, and then it was my belly button birthday. I didn't even know it was my birthday because I was so far gone, 3 days. I was there in that program for 30 days, and I can't tell you about those 30 days because it was such a blur to come down, everything, the alcohol, everything. But after 30 days, my parole officer put me in a sober living place. And there's where I think the magic began to happen in my life. You know, I was at the sober living place, and part of being there, we had to go to AA. And LOLT was nearby, and that's my home group. I love LOLT, you know, life on life's terms. They're the craziest, sickest people you ever meet. We're sick people. But I love it because I needed it at that time. And I love my home group. If you're ever in Fresno, go visit us at 710 North Fulton. And so I was there and going to meetings, but not like going there and sitting there, like taking the body, but the mind wasn't following. But the body was going. And so at this time, like I said, the years are going by, and my oldest daughter, my firstborn, my oldest daughter, I'm in this program, and I have 5 months clean. And I say clean, not sober, because to me sobriety is changing everything about you, and I wasn't there yet. I was just clean. And I was at the sober living place, and I had 5 months clean, and I had got a call that my daughter had got arrested with some gang members, and me trying to be the grandmother and worry about the kids and couldn't even take care of myself, but I was worried about my grandkids. So I go over there where my daughter's at, and there's a street on McKenzie off of Blackstone, and they're all sitting. I can remember vaguely, it's like my daughter and a bunch of people were sitting like on the curb. The cops had them on the curb. And I was walking up there to where my daughter was, and I remember from, like, we were walking from almost from here to there, and my daughter saw me, and she tells the cop, "That's my mom. She'll tell you who I am." My daughter's name was Stephanie, and she had said her name was Alicia. And when she looked at me, you know, and I looked at her, you see, I came from that. I still had that prison mentality. I'm not going to give you up no matter what. And that was my daughter, and I sure in the hell wasn't going to give her up. I still had that mentality. And so the cops had asked me my name, where I was at, and they were going to psych my daughter out, you know. But what happened was my other daughter showed up, and she didn't know what was transpiring. And she gets off her car and says, "Mom, Stephanie." And so you know what happened to us. You know, they put the cuffs on us. I don't know if you guys have felt that yet, or if that's still a yet in your life, because you're eligible too. And they put the cuffs on us, and they put us in the cop car, and we went to jail. Me for violating parole, lying to a police officer, and my daughter for, I guess she had warrants, whatever. And we're in the Fresno County Jail, and I don't know if that's a yet too. You know, we're in booking, and I'm sitting on that slab of cement, my daughter's all tweaked out. I don't know who she's talking to on the phone, but I'm sitting there on that slab of cement, and it's like I've seen my life. like I seen my life go. You know, I wasn't scared to go back to prison. I come from that life. I wasn't scared to go back to the streets. That was my life, you know. But something, and I don't know where it came from, something in the pit of my stomach to this day. I don't know, you know, like I never had that childhood, but something in the pit of my stomach, like there was just something that was not right. And this is not to judge people, but for me, for Elena, you see, I can do a whole lot of dirty shit out there. You know, I can be out there in the streets, you know, do what I had to do to survive that goes with the disease. But there was one thing that was unacceptable to Elena. See, I didn't want to be one of those mothers that went to the joint with her daughter. That was unacceptable. There's where I drew the line for me, for Elena. And that feeling came over me. And I remember saying a prayer. And I'm not talking about that little red wagon prayer we say, oh God, please just let me get away with this one. I won't do it again. I'm not talking about that prayer. All I said was, I'm through. That's all I said. I'm through. And I'm not going to tell you that lightning hit that booking room, but a feeling came over me to this day, a little over 13 years of sobriety, that has not left me, that everything was going to be all right, no matter what, no matter what. And I had to spend the weekend in jail until my parole officer lifted the hold. And I think my daughter went to prison. I'm not too sure what happened to her. But I know she didn't come out. When I went back to that sober living is where that magic began to happen for me. I can honestly say that, you know, I did a surrendering. That third step prayer made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. You know, step one, I already knew that my life was unmanageable. I had already conceded to that, you know. It's like it all happened, 1, 2, 3. And came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. You know, and I was allowed to go back to that sober living. And I was on blackout period. And I went to meetings. And that's where the magic began for me. You know, my first 2 years of sobriety, I went to 3 meetings a day. I didn't know how to live. I needed you people to teach me how to live. I can do bad all by myself. But I didn't know how to live life, you know. And so I went to 3 meetings, and I remember I got my first sponsor. That didn't turn out. I mean, she's a good friend today, but it, you know, she was in my life for that moment for a reason, and it didn't work out. And but she became my friend, and my second sponsor, well, she became one of my best friends. So she couldn't be my sponsor because she co-signed all my shit. I needed someone to tell me, you know, put me on the spot. And so she became she's one of my best friends today. And then I got the sponsor that I have today, who has a sponsor that has a sponsor, and it's a long linkage. You know, I have my grand sponsor here today. My sponsor was unable to be here, so my grand sponsor showed. And, you know, and I began to work with this lady, you know, to go through the steps, you know, she began to take me through the steps. And like I talked about the first steps, you know, the powerlessness, you know, the unmanageability, you know, the little that I share, you know, gives you an insight to my unmanageability in my life, you know. And step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And I'm not talking about like talking to the burning bushes, you know, because sometimes I can get crazy. You know, sometimes the ghetto will come out of me, you know, and I'll be like that, you know, sometimes, you know. And but the more I work in my program, the more I rely on my God, that becomes less and less in my life today. And I know that. And the third step, you know, I say that third step prayer every morning, you know, and I make a decision to turn my will over to the care of God, my understanding. See, because when I first came into these rooms, you couldn't talk to me about God. I was like the exorcist. I would say some way out shit because I didn't want you to get near me because of what happened to me in my childhood. So I didn't want you coming near me. And it was through my sponsor and the steps and praying that I found that God of my understanding. And you know, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired of the high cost of low living. That's what it amounted to. I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired of the high cost of low living. And you know, I'm getting into my fourth step, you know. The fourth step wasn't about blaming everybody. It was about looking at what Elena did. you know, making that resentment list, looking at my part. You know, not everything was in red, some was in black, and, you know, and I had to make a list of all this, you know, and the resentment, and, you know, look at my part, you know, and, you know, there was a lot that was Elena's part. There was a lot that was my part. And it gave me such a relief, though. It gave me such a relief. And the fifth step, you know, to disclose to God and another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. You know, and I have an awesome sponsor, you know, that I've had for the past 9 years. And this lady, I can share with her my deepest secrets. I mean, anything that I can imagine, I've shared with her. And you know, all she does is share her experience with me. And after she shares her experience, I don't feel that bad sometimes, you know. You know, like, damn, you know. But, you know, that's the magic of the program of AA, you know, and man, I love that lady. I love that lady, you know. She's a godsend in my life. You know, nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And the sixth step, you know, having my defects, humbly asking Him to remove those defects. No, that's the seventh step, but getting ready on that list on six and seven. And I had a lot of character defects. I mean, I was terrible. I was, you know, I mean, selfish, self-centered. I mean, all those seven deadly sins, you know, that was me. And one of them that stands out was jealousy. You know, and I always like to share about that because my boyfriend's in here. And, you know, when I first met him, he was just my friend. He was just really my friend. But my mind took me like someplace else. Like he was mine already. He didn't know it. But he was just being really nice to me. Like, you know, and I never had that in my life. Like, I didn't know. Like, I thought like, oh my God, I want him. And, you know, like, and jealousy was a big part, you know, and, I remember one time we went, he didn't have a car then, and I had a car, and we used to go to meetings together, and we went to our home group meeting, LOLT, and don't you know this girl hugged him like 30 seconds too long, and I left his ass at the meeting. He called me later on and told me, hey, girl, what's wrong with you? And, you know, and I had to be like all humbling and like, you know, but, you know, it was growth for me to admit that, you know, when I hear people laugh, they identify, you know, and it was growth for me to admit to another person about that jealousy, you know, my pride, everything, you know, but it was growth for me. And that was one of those glaring defects, you know, because I never felt smart enough, good enough, tall enough, thin enough, curly enough. I always felt so different, you know. They never felt good enough. There was always something missing in Elena that I never felt. So I wasn't looking at the inside. I was like looking at everybody else on the outside. And so I got to work on some of those defects, and they haven't gone away, all of them. You know, to me, I see my character defects like weeds. Some pop up, some go down, some pop up, and I have to continually work on my character defects because they will spring up. You know, self-seeking, selfishness, self-centered, those things can sneak up on me, you know, and I have to be careful, you know, with those character defects. I have to always be on guard, you know, on those character defects, you know. And eighth step, made a list, you know, of those people, of the men. And, you know, I used to think, you know, because one thing about the big book says, we don't just do the steps and say, okay, go have a happy life. The steps are continuing, working the steps. And I used to think before on the amends, making that list, I used to think I needed to put Elena on top of the amends list. I thought I came first. Not necessarily today, I see different, because what I've learned was through making my amends, I'm able to feel freer, forgive myself more. So it's not about putting me on top of that list. And I had to, when I made my amends, went to each of my daughters. I have four daughters. My oldest daughter, she became an addict. She's in disease. The time when I made amends to her, all she told me was, I don't know what to tell you, Mom. I don't know if I love you or hate you. I don't feel, I'm numb. And I had to accept that. And when I went to my second daughter, I took him each at different times. And my second daughter, she was, oh, it's okay, Mom. It was not that bad. I go, no, it was not okay. You know, I had to, you know, sit down with her and tell her some things, you know, that it was not okay for them to look for me. This daughter used to look for me at nighttime in the streets on Belmont, you know, and she was scared to call the cops if I didn't come home 2 or 3 days later. She was scared to call the cops because she didn't know if I was committing a crime or not. So she didn't want me to get busted. You know, the turmoil that I put in her head, you know, some of that, you know, she tells me things and, you know, and I have to tell her, no, it's not okay. And my third daughter, she was very angry. My third daughter was the angry one. She didn't want to talk to me. She would tell her sisters, oh, Mom's going to go back out again. You know, she just had a lot, and she had every right. And I remember this daughter, my third daughter, and she's special today in my life. Well, they're all special, but the relationship we have today, you know, the first 4 years of my sobriety, this daughter wouldn't talk to me. She had so much hurt, so much hate toward me. You know, and every year when I would celebrate, I would say, like, tell my sponsor, oh, well, look at me. Mom's sober now. You know, Mom needs that acknowledgement. And this went on, and I'm going on my fourth year. I remember talking with my sponsor, and she says, you know, Elena, your daughter might never come back into your life. You know, she has every right not to come back into your life. Are you doing this for you or for your kids? Because if you're doing it for your kids, it's not going to work. You got to do it for you because of the resentments. And I have to accept that. And on that fourth year, when it did come for my sobriety birthday, that daughter showed up. You know, she didn't talk, but she showed up. You know, that was... And my youngest daughter, well, she's still a work in progress. You know, little by little, there's healing going with me and her, you know. And I know that she loves me and that we... able to talk to her. You know, I was always kind of nervous with this youngest daughter to approach her. And now I'm able to do that. And, you know, and what I tell them all is, individually, is all I owe them is to not be the mother that I was before. You know, not be that mother. I don't owe them money. I don't owe them babysitting, even though they try to dump their kids on me, you know. But, you know, I just owe them is to, you know, not be the mother that I was. And I make a living amends every day by being that sober mother to my kids. And the list went down. And there's another amends that I talk about too. And it's kind of like a twist. Amends, I had a brother. And he was one of my abusers. And this brother tortured me and my other brother, burned my brother's hand. You know, and he, you know, used to like, just, it was, you know, this brother, he was one of the reasons I left home young. And so I never seen this brother when I left home. And then, like, in 1994, I would hear things, you know, like, from that little town, friends. And in 1994, I heard that my brother had got arrested, and they had barely started that three strikes, you're out law that came in. And my brother was one of the first to get on that three strikes. And he was given a 50-to-life sentence for whatever crime he committed. And so life went on. You know, my brother went to prison, and like I had heard about it, and I said, okay. Oh, I got one. And my brother, so I said, oh, you know, I had heard through the grapevine. So I was like, okay, out of mind, out of sight. And so when I was like one time thinking about I was going to forgive this brother, because when I first got sober, and like, what made him be that? What happened to him to make him be that monster to me? You know, and I thought about that forgiveness, and I thought I forgave this brother, you know, because I was never going to see him anyway. He was in prison for life. That's what I heard. And so one day, like about 5 years ago, that was like a turning point in my life. A lot of events happened to me 5 years ago. I'm at work. And I'm sitting down at work, and then I get this phone call. And at first, I thought it was somebody I owe money, you know, those bill collectors, because they're asking me these questions. I'm trying to, like, damn, now they want my money. But, but no, it was a lawyer. I don't know how he found me, but he found me. And my brother had, at this time, my brother had been locked up 22 years. And the lawyer had asked me, and he told me that, My brother was brought back to the county jail under the resentencing law. 5 years ago started the resentencing law. And then my brother requested, that my brother wanted me to go visit him and this and that. And so he just told me that, and I said, okay. So I didn't know, you know, like, I didn't know how to act. But I went to go visit my brother. And I remember when I visit my brother, I visit him behind a glass. His visits were behind a glass. And we were talking, and he just started talking, like trying to order me around, like from the past, you know, like, it was like I regressed back to that little girl. That's how I felt. I regressed back to that little girl. And anyway, I left that visiting, and I remember talking to my sponsor. And my sponsor suggested, you know, Lena, you go back and you visit him and you tell him who you are today. You're not that little girl. You know, just tell him what you're doing in your life, you know, to walk through that fear. And so I went back and I went to visit my brother, and I just told him that I was in AA, that, you know, that I had done some healing, that I even done some therapy. The big book sometimes suggests we seek outside help. I had to seek outside help. And I said it like in a nonchalant way, but I guess anyway, he got mad and he hung up and told me, don't ever come and see him around again, this and that, and hung the phone. And I walked out. You know, and I go about my business, and then about like 2 months later, I get this call from this lawyer again. And the lawyer says, your brother's going to get sentenced. It was close to my sobriety and my belly button birthday, because they're 3 days apart. It was close to that period, or somewhere close. And he says, your brother's about to get sentenced. He might go back to prison for life, but he's requesting your presence. And I said, okay, you know. You know, because I had to act normal talking to this lawyer. I couldn't, like, tell him what I really wanted to say. But, you know, I was just like, okay, you know. And anyway, so I had talked to one of my daughters, and my daughter was saying, you know, Mom, I'll go with you. You know, and so we went to my brother's sentencing. And I don't know if any of you guys have been in the courtroom with that still yet, but we're in the courtroom, and they're there, and we're back here. And you know, when you're in jail, I don't know how many have been there yet, but you make roses out of toilet paper. And my brother had made a rose, and he had gave it to the lawyer. And he had told the lawyer to tell me that he was sorry if he never saw me again. And happy birthday. And it's like I broke, like I cried, like all my life I waited to hear those words. You know, that was like a freedom to me. And it was at that moment I felt like my God revealed to me, who was I to rob my brother of that opportunity to make his right? No, but he didn't rob me of my opportunity to make my amends. And it's like a dam, like, you know, like I had so much freedom that, like, I can talk about it. And, you know, like, it's like I was waiting all my life to hear those words. And my brother was let out. And when my brother got out, he got out, and, he was out for 5 months, and he died. And when my brother died, this brother that I despised so much, I was able to give him a proper barrier, a proper service. You know, that's what the program taught me, and that's what the steps. You know, because it was not so much for him, it was for me, the healing, the forgiveness. And that was a very, very strong amends that stays in me to this day. You know, and the amends, and I've had other opportunities to do other amends to other people. You know, there's some that you do now, maybe never, you know, but God will reveal the time. I mean, I didn't go to the stores and tell them I robbed them either. You know, that's why we have step two. You know, that's why we have step two. You know, you don't go tell them, you know, I just don't steal today. I pay for everything. You know, and I do right today. You know, when it comes to institutions, on my amends. You know. And the 10th step, you know, the 10th step, that daily inventory, the personal inventory, you know, I do that. I do that every night. I lay my head on that pillow. What could I have said better? What could I have done better? Because sometimes, you know, it's spiritual progress, not perfection. And sometimes I can just come out of left field, and I have to be able to catch myself, you know, and be that better person the next day, you know, or promptly admitted it if I offend someone. You know, I can say, hey, you know, I was wrong. I was wrong. I can do that today, you know. I don't have to have my pride in the way. I can go up to somebody and say, I was wrong for offending. It was, you know, you're right. You know, the 10-step inventory. And the 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation. You know, that sought through prayer and meditation is to improve my conscious with my higher power. You know, 5 years ago, I got real sick. I was really sick. They didn't know if I had cancer. They didn't know what was wrong with me, but I had a kidney disease, and I had to really improve that conscious contact. And kind of goes hand in hand with the 11th and the 12th, because there's a page in the big book, goes something in page 15 that says something like, how appallingly true for the alcoholic who fails to enlarge his spiritual life through self-sacrifice and working with others for when those trials, those spots come. You know, and how true was that statement in this book, in page 15, at that time for me in my life. You know, when I thought of step 11, I thought of those words. You know, five years I got really sick. I had a kidney disease. I thank God for the friends here that I have from Fresno and other people, my women's group that supported me through taking me to doctor's appointments. I mean, it was like constant doctors they couldn't figure out, but they were going to put me on dialysis. I needed to be put on the kidney transplant list. You know, and my years, my God has relieved me of the obsession to drink. But when I got sick, and as the time went closer and closer to getting on dialysis, I couldn't see myself hooked up to a machine. I just couldn't. And I thought of suicide, you know, and I was able to share that. Now today I can share about it. You know, I knew what I could take to shut me down, you know. I didn't think about drinking, but I thought of suicide. I just couldn't see myself hooked up. And I remember, you know, that 11-step prayer and, you know, working with others, continue to go to meetings, continue to work with others. I was down to 8% kidney function 19 months ago. And my doctor, you know, I would beg her, you know, oh, don't put me on dialysis. And, you know, she was an awesome doctor at Kaiser, you know, and finally the day said, you know, Lena, this is it. Next week, you have to get on dialysis. And I never lost faith, but there were some moments I did lose it. At the same time, I can't explain that feeling. And I remember on May the 7th, 2017, I was going to bed, and because I was getting ready to go to work. And even with 8% kidney function, I was still working. And I was 11:15 p.m. and I got the call, and it was bittersweet. I got a call, and at first I thought it was my daughter Trisha, because her name is Patricia, and it was this lady. She told me her name was Trish, and she asked me about me, and I said yeah. And she goes, this is Trish. I'm the nurse from UCSF, and she goes, we just had a 21-year-old male pass away in New York from opiate abuse, and you were the perfect match in the national database. How soon can you get to San Francisco at UCF? By 3 o'clock that morning, I was in San Francisco. My daughter, her boyfriend, drove me. And May the 8th, I got that kidney. You know, and that was like so, so, so real. And, you know, in the transplant unit at UCSF, there's a saying that through the wound is where the light enters. You know, and that's like so, I correlated it with AA. And I remember my boyfriend coming to see me the day after I had the surgery, and he spent the night, and he slept in the hospital bed. He was trying to be all like, you know, respectful, sit on the chair. And I said, no, he didn't sleep on the bed with me. So he slept on the bed, and we got up in the morning, and from my window you can see the ocean in San Francisco, and we woke up to the third step prayer, saying the third step prayer, you know, and tears, and, you know, that you know, how awesome is my God, you know? You know, undeserved. And, you know, it's through His grace I'm here. You know, and it was bittersweet because I thought of that 21-year-old youth, you know, the guy, You know, and, you know, in my life, you know, all because I became willing to do this thing called AA. You know, when I'm asked to speak, I speak, you know. And the 12 step, you know, carrying the message, you know. I'm involved in H&I, you know, and there's a lot I do for AA. You know, I've been blessed, you know. I've been blessed because of AA. I've learned to live life. And this is not to brag, you know. I only had an 8th grade education. I got my GED. I'm working now on my bachelor's, you know. Licensed by the state of California, you know, like, I'm employable, you know. You know, I'm not, you know, and that's all because of you people. I just follow you guys. I see what you guys do, you know, the attraction, you know, and I've been blessed in so many ways. And what I love most is all my life, I was looking for someone to love Elena. And in this room, I found that person. I found Elena. Thank you.